the day everything stopped. 23rd March 2020, the day everything stopped. The first Christmas in our new home was something out of a snow globe, magical, warm, glittering with the kind of hope that only December can bring. We'd taken Diane's grandchildren on a festive adventure to a Christmas grotto tucked away in a nursery near Mark Cross, just off the winding A267 that snakes from Tunbridge Wells down toward Eastbourne. It felt like stumbling into the pages of a children's book. The entrance was framed by twinkling lights and fir trees dusted with artificial snow. Inside, the air smelled of pine needles, hot chocolate, and cinnamon. Children were led into a craft room filled with soft carols, laughter, and little tables where they decorated gingerbread men, made Christmas cards, and wrote letters to Santa with wide eyes and sticky fingers. Then came the main event, a walk through an enchanted path of fairy lights, toy soldiers, and wooden reindeer, before stepping into a warm log cabin where Father Christmas himself waited, grand and jolly in a deep red robe, surrounded by old-fashioned toys and velvet sacks. The children were spellbound, their cheeks pink from the cold, their faces lit with that rare, untouchable kind of joy. It was pure magic. We left with photos, keepsake baubles, and a kind of glowing happiness that lingered all the way home. Back at the house, Diane had truly outdone herself. A tall Christmas tree stood in the front room, draped in gold, silver, and pearlescent white. The kind of tree you'd expect in a glossy department store window, but somehow warmer, more real. Harrods would have tipped its hat. The rest of the house sparkled in unison. Elegant garlands, flickering candles, not a plastic Santa in sight. Even the fence outside was lined with white fairy lights, glowing gently against the black of night. It wasn't overdone. It was perfectly festive, tasteful, and filled with care. She'd already started planning the next phase of nesting. The downstairs loo, she declared, needed a wash basin. And she wasn't wrong. I could see her eyeing tiles and taps before we'd even put the tree away. The central heating boiler, naturally, chose that winter to give up entirely. But unlike the old days in Grove Park, where financial dread crept into every corner, this time we just replaced it. No drama, no debt collector around the corner, no stomach-churning anxiety. Still, I knew I wasn't out of the woods. I owed Mike and Zoe £20,000, my share of the house arrangement, and it hung there in my mind like an unpaid promise. But I had a plan. 6 to 8 months in, I'd remortgage. Diane wanted the cracked old tarmac drive replaced with clean brick paving and a smart wooden gate, something to stop delivery vans from treating our front garden like a cul-de-sac depot. Despite the signs, they parked up anyway, mistaking our drive for public access to the neighboring houses. I understood her frustration, but I could see the vision too. It was all doable. Just not overnight. So, in the meantime, I focused on pistachios, on checking in with my boys, and above all, on soaking in every precious visit from Iris and Parker. Those moments were grounding, joyful. Outside our home, the world was shifting. Brexit was looming like a foghorn in the background. Even the local farmers were rattled. I saw a piece on Countryfile about a beautiful organic farm near Alfriston, just down the A27, struggling with the knowledge that, out of the EU, they'd be up against cheap imported meat from the US and Argentina. They mentioned a pub, the Sussex Ox, owned by the farm, where the menu was proudly filled with their own meat. It sounded too good not to try. Diane didn't seem particularly interested, so one crisp, cold winter day, I took myself. The place was exactly what I hoped. Roaring fire, thick-beamed ceilings, the smell of roasting meat and mulled wine. Walkers and locals huddled inside, red-cheeked and laughing. The steak was extraordinary, the cheese board sublime, the wine rich and warming. Diane had missed a treat. On another day, coming back from the Reigate and Red Hill cafes, I was cruising along the A27 when Fred called. "Where are you?" he asked. "On my way home," I replied. "We're at the Smuggler's Inn in Alfriston. Me and Denise, come join us." How could I possibly say no? Fred and Denise, an old friend, now something far more, had spent the day tracing the windswept curves of the Seven Sisters, and were rounding it off with a night at the George Inn, their laughter already echoing through its weathered beams. I veered off course and joined them. The evening unfolded like something both long-awaited and instantly familiar. It was wonderful, rich with old stories, new glances, and the quiet comfort of belonging. and Alfriston itself, chocolate box perfection. Somewhere I knew I'd want to take Diane. Life was ticking forward, quietly, gently, not always smoothly. Our relationship wasn't exactly what I'd hoped for, but I was committed to making it work. I knew my financial support for my sons and my tendency to take risks didn't always sit well with Diane. But that was the road I walked. Without the risks, I wouldn't have got us here. I had also started on a weight loss mission. Gary, my mentor, had checked out by then, but I kept going, right up until Christmas, that is. The pub lunches rolled back in, the red wine flowed, and the cheese boards returned with a vengeance. Still, I told myself I'd get back to it in January. Always January. And then, March arrived. It was a Monday night, bitter outside, eerily still. Something was coming. You could feel it in your bones. The news had been creeping in for days. Italy, in full lockdown. Spain, silent. New York, deserted. And still, I thought, not here, not really, not us. But then, at 8:30 p.m., everything changed. Boris Johnson appeared on television, pale, stern, the weight of something heavy behind his eyes. From this evening, I must give the British people a very simple instruction. You must stay at home. There it was. The hammer blow. The sentence that would split time in two, before lockdown and after. We were told we could leave the house for only four reasons. Essential food shopping, medical needs, one walk or exercise a day, or if our job was essential and couldn't be done from home. That was it. And just like that, it wasn't just the country that shut down. Our lives did too. That's what lockdown became in our house. A strange balancing act between peace and panic, gratitude and fatigue. We laughed, sometimes. We snapped. We watched far too much news. We cried behind bathroom doors. We drank too much wine. We lived together in suspension, like satellites orbiting the same point but never quite touching. And all the while, Eastbourne remained hauntingly still. The beach, once dotted with pensioners and prams, was bare. The promenade stretched on like a photograph. The waves rolled in, slow, rhythmic, undisturbed, as if time itself had paused. There were no footprints on the sand, no markings of human presence, just smooth, windswept stillness. Above, the sky stretched wide and clear, scrubbed of its usual haze. With the air free of pollution, France emerged on the horizon, crisp and unhampered, a distant silhouette that rarely showed itself so boldly, like a secret suddenly revealed. No bikes, no dogs chasing tennis balls, only the gulls remained. Their cries, now deafening, rang out like sirens through the emptiness. The wind, usually lost in the noise of cars and chatter, swept through the town like a whisper from a forgotten world. The town had fallen asleep, and we were inside the dream. We were all waiting. For what, we didn't know. But we knew this much. We wouldn't be the same on the other side of it. All of our cafes in the parks were forced to close, immediately. No time to plan, no warning. One moment they were buzzing with families, dogs, laughter, and the comforting hum of espresso machines. The next, empty, silent. Machines switched off, chairs stacked, staff sent home, notes pinned to the doors, closed, until further notice. It felt like fiction, like a dystopian drama had torn through the veil of reality. The next morning I walked through Hampden Park. The air was sharp, the sky an unearthly blue, but the silence was wrong. Too clean, too complete. No children, no clink of cups, just birdsong and the occasional gust of wind rattling the leaves. Even the ducks looked baffled. The police had been granted powers to question, fine, even detain. Strangers crossed streets to avoid each other. A cough in public, like firing a gun. Everyone was suspect, even yourself. Back at home, I tried to keep order. Franchisees were messaging me at all hours, panicked, bewildered, voices tight with fear. What does furlough actually mean? Do I have to close today? Will I get any support at all? It was chaos. No one understood the rules, and the rules themselves kept changing. One moment we were told to stay open for takeaway, the next it was unsafe to serve a single customer. I could feel the fear building across the network like a pressure valve ready to burst. These were people with rents to pay, families to feed, stock already purchased, and zero idea what tomorrow looked like. I turned to the one tool I had some control over, our Pistachios in the Park app. Originally built for updates, menus, and events, it quickly became our lifeline. I began uploading every government announcement, every furlough guideline, every piece of COVID-related legislation I could get my hands on. Within days, the app transformed from a marketing tool into a digital war room. Clear, calm information, translated into human language. No political spin, no jargon. Just, here's what you need to know. Here's what you need to do. It was the only way I could steady the ship while the storm swirled around us. The news was a horror loop. Death tolls, ventilator shortages, hospitals overflowing. We clapped on Thursdays, banging pans and applauding the NHS, but even hope felt fragile. The world paused, our freedom, our routine, our income, suspended overnight. Some people found peace in the stillness, others found madness. For me, it was a moment of eerie, unshakable clarity. The day the cafes closed, the day the world fell still. After Boris's announcement, I helped Ben shut down his cafe. It was like pulling down the shutters on a part of our lives we weren't sure we'd ever get back. We sorted through stock, donated what we could, wiped down surfaces, packed away everything with the dull resignation of soldiers retreating from a lost battle. There was no roadmap, no timeline, just an eerie sense that something enormous had shifted and none of us really knew what the next day would bring. Then, just as we were locking up, something extraordinary happened. An elderly customer, one of Ben's loyal regulars, appeared at the door, flustered but determined. She stepped inside, coat buttoned to the neck, eyes glassy with emotion, and pressed a check for £1,000 into Ben's hand. "I heard the news," she said, breath catching. "You've got a young family. You work so hard, 7 days a week if needed. I can afford this. Please take it. No arguments. But promise me something. Don't ever tell anyone where it came from." Ben was stunned. Moved beyond words, tears filled his eyes as he nodded, overwhelmed by the quiet generosity of someone who simply cared. In a world spinning into uncertainty, it was a moment of startling clarity, kindness standing tall in the rubble. I drove home in silence, my mind thick with thoughts. Eastbourne lay ahead like a painting stripped of its color. No traffic, no noise, just road. When I pulled into our driveway and switched off the engine, the silence was almost theatrical. No rumble of cars on the road, no dog walkers chatting as they passed, just a kind of suspended stillness that settled over everything. I stepped out of the van, the gravel beneath my shoes sounding loud, alien, intrusive. I locked up, walked to the front door, and paused. Inside the hallway, I hung my keys in the wooden box above the washstand. A small gesture, but one that said so much. I wouldn't be needing them, not for a while. Diane had already called to cancel all our car insurance policies, one of 100 little ways we were battening down the hatches. I picked up the phone and called Halifax, arranged a mortgage holiday. With a full house and no income on the horizon, we'd need to cut every possible cost. And all around us, Eastbourne had changed. Lockdown in Eastbourne was like stepping into another world. The town, usually a gentle hum of activity, retirees chatting on benches, pushchairs rolling down the promenade, the scent of coffee wafting from open cafes, was now unsettlingly quiet. The bandstand was empty, the seafront shops dark, the beach deserted. Not even a lone child skimming stones into the sea. The familiar sounds of life had vanished, replaced by one sound alone, seagulls. Their cries echoed through the hollow streets with an eerie sharpness. With no cars, no laughter, no footsteps to dull them, their screeches felt strange. Amplified. Haunting. As if the birds themselves were circling in confusion, calling out across the silence, "Where is everyone?" With each flap of their wings and each piercing call, it was like the town had been claimed by something otherworldly, part ghost story, part dream. Even the wind felt different. It whistled through the empty high streets and along the seawall like a sound effect from a film set. It was surreal. Eastbourne, the cheerful seaside escape, had become a postcard from a world paused. Back inside, Diane was already deep in worry. Her mum, Opal, was vulnerable. Caitlin had arranged to pick her up and bring her with the kids to stay with us through lockdown. It was the sensible choice, and I didn't object, though I wasn't exactly thrilled. Opal and I had a complicated relationship. I found her manipulative, sometimes selfish. But maybe that was just me. Maybe I just didn't like being controlled. Still, I knew keeping her safe was important, and I'd grit my teeth if that's what it took. I wished Josh and Remy would do the same and come down, but they chose to ride it out in their own way. Ben was staying put, too, at home with Alina, her mum, and the girls. He was calm, focused. Me? I was quietly dreading the tension a full house might bring, but at the same time, I welcomed the thought of Iris and Parker under our roof. Parker was only 2. Born on the 16th of February 2018, just a few short breaths before the world started to feel like it was spinning in reverse. He was tiny, wide-eyed, and impossibly delicate. Beautiful, really. With a soft mop of hair and a permanent expression of deep, thoughtful puzzlement, as though even then he was trying to make sense of a world that often made no sense at all. He came with a list of allergies that felt more suited to a hospital chart than a toddler's record. Dairy, sunflower oil, pineapple, the last one the most surprising, the others all too familiar. We didn't say it with blame, not really, but we all knew who to thank for that genetic inheritance, Theo. He too had lived through childhood with dairy intolerance and a catalog of sensitivities that meant mealtimes were more chemistry than cuisine. Parker was sensitive in body, but in spirit, he was bold, stubborn, curious, adorable beyond reason. And as he grew, he started to remind me of someone. Young Sheldon, that brilliant little oddball from Netflix's spin-off of The Big Bang Theory. The resemblance was uncanny, not in looks, but in temperament. Serious, observant, almost comically precise. He'd line things up, he'd correct people. He had a way of looking at you like he was running your thoughts through a mental equation. He was Nanny's boy through and through, wrapped around Diane's finger, happiest when curled up next to her or bossing her about with toddler-sized authority. But Iris, she was mine. All mine. No one else even came close. Iris and I had always been close. She lit up the place in a way only children can. Having her near, especially in a moment like this, felt like a gift. But the weight of it all was starting to press. The furlough scheme was rolled out. Great news for cafe staff. But for people like me, like Diane, and for our franchisees who paid themselves in dividends as accountants had long advised, it meant nothing. We weren't included. Our income vanished, and the safety net wasn't built for us. Pistachios in the Park loved it had been doing well. We were poised for a strong spring, our busiest season. But then came COVID, and it hit like a wrecking ball. In a matter of days, our momentum was snatched away. What should have been a burst of growth was instead extinguished, like snuffing a candle between wet fingers. We'd already been drained by a drawn-out court case. Sharn, an ex-franchisee, had sued us for misrepresentation. We won in the high court, but the legal costs were immense. His team appealed and won. Now we were heading back into battle. The money we should have had for rainy days was gone, eaten alive by lawyers and legal fees. The only thing keeping us afloat were the regular management fees still trickling in. But with every passing day of lockdown, we were bleeding. And so was Eastbourne. Not visibly, but in the silence, in the stillness, in the way the gulls cried louder, in the way the wind moved through the streets like a whisper no one wanted to hear. We were all waiting, all holding our breath, and none of us knew how or when it would end. The days that followed settled into a rhythm that felt both strangely familiar and utterly absurd. Time lost its grip, its structure dissolved, hours bled into one another, weekdays became meaningless. There were no school runs, no cafe openings, no plans, just an indefinite stretch of suspended living. We were suddenly all home. All the time. 7+1. Under one roof. Me, Diane, Opal, Caitlin, the 2 kids, and Theo, plus Jenna, Theo's girlfriend, who arrived each morning like clockwork to continue working with him from our annex. He'd took up residence there, turning it into a home office, a bunker, a last stand for his company, desperately trying to keep it afloat. Theo had moved into the annex not long after the tenant left, a young woman who'd just bought her own place. True to form, Diane never told me Theo was moving into it. Not until he was already settled. She arranged it, set the rent with him. Pound, 100 short of what the tenant had paid, and the payments went straight to her. Not to me, as they did before. And though I said nothing, didn't cause a fuss deep down. That hurt. Not for the money, but for the silence. For not being part of a decision that affected our home. It was a familiar feeling, one I'd learned to swallow over the years. Theo and Jenna worked hard. He'd arranged furlough for most of his staff, kept a handful of trusted salesmen on, and he and Jenna made new calls, pushed out the deals, trying to keep the heartbeat of the business alive from the little annex with its thin walls and shared Wi-Fi. Ben stayed put with Alina and their girls. Josh and Raimi chose not to come down either, checking in now and then with quick messages or the odd FaceTime. I missed them, but I didn't push. Everyone was scared in their own way. My mom and dad stayed put too. Proud, stoic, fiercely independent. "We're fine," Dad insisted on our first video call. "We'll stay up here. You take care of yours, and we'll keep to our bubble." His ear was permanently glued to the news. He could read between the lines better than most politicians, and he knew, we were going to struggle. A week later, a letter arrived. Inside, a check for £4,000 from my dad with a note, "Give £1,000 to Ben. Share the rest between yourself, Remy, and Josh if they need it. You're not in this alone." It broke me. At first, there was something oddly novel about it all. Mornings slowed down. Diane, in her element, took control. Proper breakfasts returned. Scrambled eggs, cereal, croissants. The kettle was always boiling. The kids turned the living room into a kingdom of chaos. Blankets draped over chairs, Lego landmines scattered across the floor. The television played nursery rhymes and cartoons on loop, while Opal, our unshakable monarch, claimed her throne in the corner armchair like the Queen Mother, glued to the news and her beloved soaps, dispensing a steady flow of judgment and opinions nobody had asked for. Diane was brilliant, steady, focused, practical. She rationed food without ever making it feel sparse. She kept an eye on the headlines and a list on the fridge. Hand washing became a ritual. She disguised her fear with productivity. I tried to do the same, keeping busy, keeping moving. I tidied drawers that hadn't seen daylight in years, cleared out the shed that had become a graveyard for forgotten tools and spider kingdoms. When the walls felt too close, I took to my bike, cycling through Eastbourne stillness, exploring streets I'd never noticed before. With the town silenced, I saw it differently. Back roads opened into hidden parks, quiet lanes led to sleepy crescents, and then the seafront, empty but beautiful. It was there I stumbled upon Fusciardi's, a small shuttered cafe near the water, a faded sign above the door boasting homemade ice cream. I stopped, dismounted, peered through the window. I imagined the scent of fresh waffle cones and cold lemon sorbet, and made a silent promise to myself, when this is over, I'm coming back. Not just for the ice cream, for the joy of it, for the simple act of choosing to stop, sit, and savor something again. That's what lockdown became in our house, a strange balancing act between peace and panic, gratitude and fatigue. We laughed, sometimes, we snapped. We watched far too much news, we cried behind bathroom doors, we drank too much wine. We lived together in suspension, like satellites orbiting the same point but never quite touching. I needed to stay busy, to feel like I still had a role in all of this. But under the surface, the tension began to grow. It buzzed through the walls like static. Opal got under my skin. She always had a way of making herself the center of things, effortlessly. I caught her undermining Diane in that maddening, passive-aggressive tone only mothers seem to master. I said nothing, but I kept my distance. Diane was already carrying enough. Meanwhile, the looming weight of money pressed heavier each day. Furlough wasn't there for us, not for me, not for Diane. Not for the many self-employed and owner-operators like our franchisees who paid themselves through dividends, perfectly legal, tax-efficient, and now completely excluded. I kept up a brave face for them. Daily, I updated the Pistachios app, pushing out whatever I could. Furlough updates, government schemes, bite-sized guidance. It gave me structure, it gave me purpose, even if inside I felt like I was unraveling. Because the truth was, I was scared. Scared for our business, for our finances, for what this virus was doing to people's minds, not just their lungs, mine included. And yet, amid the noise and silence, came the light. Iris. She was my anchor, bright, curious, wonderfully unaware of the true weight of what was happening. She knew something had changed, but not the details, just that everything felt quieter, closer. Each day we took our one permitted walk, me and her, hand in hand, through the woods into Hampton Park, past the shuttered sleeping cafe and silent swing sets. The park was empty. Our footsteps echoed. And still Iris found joy. She picked up twigs and stones and feathers, declaring them treasure. She danced down the paths. She smiled at the gulls. We baked together. We danced to old records in the kitchen. We built dens from bedsheets and flashlights and had midnight feasts of crackers and raisins under the stars of her imagination. In those moments, it felt like everything was going to be okay. Not perfect, not normal, but okay. Then in May, something shifted. After weeks of mounting pressure, financial uncertainty, and sleepless nights, a breakthrough arrived, a crack of light in the darkness. For the first time in months, it felt like hope and help were finally on the horizon. On 4th May 2020, the government launched the Bounce Back Loan Scheme, BBLS. It wasn't just a gesture, it was a lifeline. For businesses like ours, who had been excluded from furlough support simply because we paid ourselves via dividends, this was the first real offer of relief. The scheme allowed small companies to borrow up to £50,000 with nothing to repay for 12 months, and the loan was 100% backed by the government, dramatically lowering the risk for lenders. It was exactly the breathing room we needed. I didn't hesitate. I applied immediately for Pistachios in the Park Limited, and I helped Ben do the same for his cafe business. This wasn't just financial support, it was oxygen. With those funds, I could finally repay Mike and Zoe the £20,000 I owed them by the end of the year. We could get going on Diane's long-dreamed-of driveway, and Theo offered to build the front gate himself as a surprise for her birthday. For the first time in weeks, we had a cushion in the bank, money set aside in case the world turned upside down again. And just as I exhaled, more good news landed. The government introduced small business grants for companies in the retail, hospitality, and leisure sectors, ranging from £10,000 to £25,000. We qualified for two, £3,000 for Banstead, which went directly to Ben, and £10,000 for Redhill and Raygate, which came into our account. Other franchisees also received grants suited to their sites. Across the board, it was a much-needed boost, a flicker of confidence, a chance to plan. Shortly after the BBL announcement, the government made its move. Takeaway cafes could reopen. No sit-down service, no lingering customers, strictly grab and go. Social distancing was law. Hand-washing rituals became gospel. And the message was clear: stay alert. At any moment, an area could be plunged back into full lockdown if the virus surged and deaths spiked. They called it the tier system, numbers that dictated your fate. A single outbreak could send you straight back to zero. But before a single cappuccino could cross a counter, the government dropped another bombshell. Every cafe had to complete a detailed COVID-specific risk assessment. Submit it to the local council, wait for approval. No approval, no opening, not even for takeaway. And the list of requirements was brutal. Social distancing protocols, PPE for every member of staff, contactless payment only, floor markings, one-way systems, and crowd control. Deep cleaning schedules, logged and visible, restricted toilet access, ironclad rules on food and drink prep. It wasn't optional, it was survival. To save time and the franchise, I built a master plan, a comprehensive COVID-19 risk assessment meticulously drafted for every Pistachio site. It covered everything, from hand-washing drills to Legionella prevention, from PPE protocols to the choreography of customer flow. Each franchisee got a copy they could tweak to fit their layout. Submit it, get approved, get trading, cautiously, nervously, but alive. It worked. Councils signed off. Slowly, our cafes flickered back to life. And then the unexpected call. Abed, Markfield Cafe, once one of ours, now independent. He'd been shut down like the rest of us, blinds pulled, espresso machines cold. But now, with takeaway allowed, he needed that golden ticket, a risk assessment. Problem was, he didn't have a clue where to start. I didn't think twice. I knew his cafe like the back of my hand, the kitchen, the customer flow, the pinch points that could make or break compliance. So I sat down and wrote him a plan from scratch. Tailored, watertight, no charge, no questions, just help. Because in times like these, the rule was simple. You either stood together, or you didn't stand at all. Diane wasn't impressed. She saw it as a liberty, a cheek to ask me for professional support without payment, especially when we were juggling our own pressures. But to me, it wasn't about money. It was about doing what was right. We were all in this together. If someone needed help getting back on their feet, and I could offer it, why wouldn't I? The road to reopening. The country began to stir, slowly, cautiously. 11th of May 2020, a crack in the curtain. People in England were finally allowed to meet one other person outdoors, at a distance of 2 meters, of course. Cafes and restaurants remained shut, but you could feel it in the air. A shift. The whispers of reopening were beginning to swell into something louder. 1st June 2020, movement returned. Parks and gardens reopened, and small outdoor gatherings of up to 6 were permitted. You could hear laughter again, muted, spaced out, cautious, but it was there. 3-4 June 2020, councils gave the green light for cafes, takeaways, and outdoor hospitality to reopen, under strict conditions. PPE, Perspex screens, distancing, sanitization protocols like clockwork. By early June, our Pistachios cafes began to stir back to life. They looked different. Face shields on staff, gloves on hands, tape on floors marking where customers could stand. The air was clinical, the atmosphere subdued. Gone were the clinks of cutlery and buzz of conversation. Orders were handed over with distance instead of smiles. Chairs stacked, tables taped off. The warm hum of cafe life reduced to a whisper, but we were open. It wasn't the cafe culture we loved, but it was movement. It was a beginning. What struck me most was the timing. The bounce-back loans had been launched a month earlier, before any reopening was even possible. For once, the government had been proactive, giving us time to breathe, prepare, plan. It wasn't perfect, it wasn't easy, but it was hope in motion. After months of holding our breath, we could finally start to exhale. When the call came, the cafes could reopen. Not fully, but takeaways and park cafes were allowed to trade again under strict COVID safety measures. I was out the door like a shot. No hesitation. Back in motion. I grabbed my keys, threw on my jacket, and jumped into the Toyota Hilux van, which had been sat dormant on the driveway since lockdown began. I didn't even look back. I just set off, fueled by purpose. Lewisham was the first stop. 3 cafes within arm's reach. Hilly Fields, Greenwich, Manor House Gardens. I needed to be there. To see the sights, to speak with staff, to guide, advise, ensure that risk assessments were in place and councils were satisfied. The adrenaline hit me like caffeine. I felt alive again, moving, leading, fixing. But I'd made one mistake, a big one. And our cafes were right there in the middle of it all, steaming out coffee, boxed up brunches, and slices of something comforting. It was a blessing. We'd lost nearly 3.5 months of trade, and now, finally, we had the chance to claw some of it back. Opportunity, I've always believed, doesn't wait. It walks right past you if you don't wave it down. I approached Gemma from Glendale and Lewisham and offered to take on the kiosk in Little Manor Park. At first, I had Don and Lynn in mind for it, but once again, they declined. Maybe it was COVID. Maybe it was the fear of overextending during such uncertain times. Whatever the reason, I didn't push. Instead, I turned to Josh. He wasn't working at the time, and I offered him the site for a symbolic £100 per month rent. He jumped at the chance, and within days, he too was off and running. Another cafe open, another park brought back to life. Little Manor Park may be small in size, but it's a gem tucked into the heart of Lewisham. A quiet retreat from the urban sprawl, it's beloved by locals for its mature trees, shaded pathways, and open green space that feels like a secret garden. The kiosk sat near the playground, a hub for parents, prams, and playground giggles. Reopening that cafe meant restoring something the community had deeply missed. Then, on a trip to check in on our Banstead Cafe, I noticed the car park at Banstead Woods was heaving. The woods were alive with movement, ramblers, joggers, dog walkers, fitness fanatics. I saw an opening. What if we could set up a mobile catering trailer here? Just a few paces from where Nathalie would serve her first coffee stood something utterly magical, a life-sized wooden wardrobe nestled among the trees. The entrance to Narnia. Banstead Woods had become home to a one-of-a-kind Narnia-themed nature trail, drawing children and families from all around. Visitors could walk through a carved wardrobe with hanging coats, meet Aslan the Lion, and find Lucy Pevensey waiting by the iconic lamppost. Each post on the trail depicted characters from the beloved book as well as the woodland's rich flora and fauna. Created from standing deadwood by sculptor Ella of the Tree Pirates, the figures were carved right from the forest's natural resources. It was a world within a world, a place where imagination ran free, where the weight of COVID didn't follow. Installed by Raygate and Banstead Council's Green Spaces team and supported by the C.S. Lewis Company Lidded, the trail was more than whimsical. It was healing. It gave families something to marvel at, something to share, and something to look forward to. Chipstead Downs and Banstead Woods, beloved by nature lovers and history buffs alike, now had a new story to tell. These landscapes mentioned in the Domesday Book and once owned by kings, knights, and the founders of great banks were steeped in history. And now they carried a new layer, fantasy. We were serving the community, and the wardrobe to Narnia, it was the perfect symbol, a gateway to wonder, even in the darkest of times. I reached out to Reigate Council, not expecting much, but to my surprise, Steve McLeod, always a straight talker, was supportive. He handled the paperwork and simply added the site to our existing concession agreement. Just like that, we had permission. Now I needed someone to run it. After some digging and a few calls, I found Nathalie, a local woman who had trained as a school cook. She'd always dreamed of launching her own catering business and had invested in a van that she'd converted into a food trailer just before the pandemic hit. She called it Nat's Kitchen. Then COVID happened. Everything stalled. But now, with restrictions easing and takeaway cafes thriving, she lacked only one thing. A location we met, we talked. Soon after, she signed up as a Pistachios in the Park franchisee. I looked at what we were building. The buzzing cafes, Nathalie's trailer surrounded by walkers, the trail leading children into stories, and for the first time in a long time, I believed in magic again. We weren't just serving coffee anymore, we were serving community. And the wardrobe to Narnia? It was the perfect symbol, a gateway to wonder, even in the darkest of times. Even with COVID still very much among us, we were building again, finding new ground to stand on, making space for others, turning stillness into motion. And I wasn't done yet.